had two kids in family court. First, dad was charged with domestic violence, was given 50-50 joint time starting out. Have had to co-parent with him. He's been aggressive at court-ordered exchanges. I've been co-parenting since child was one, and child is now 15. Child started reporting abuse emotionally and physically by dad and started refusing visitation due to dad's angry outbursts. Police and family courts all sided with dad and stated dad could discipline however means necessary. I was reprimanded by family court and lost custody. My child still reports abuse by dad and favors me. Second child. Dad has reported in writing to being a pedophile and having a problem with underage images. Family court gave dad 50-50 custody of the child at 4 months old. Child started reporting sexual assault by dad at 4 years old. I took child to be investigated and reported a lot, but then family court twisted it to look like I coached the child. I'm now on supervised visits. I'm the child's baseball coach, no substance issues, deeply religious and educated, and no history of mental illness. No major mental health provider has examined the father. Child was very bonded to me. Hi, I'm Zahn Velines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, as you might expect from that vignette, we are going to be talking about how the legal system affects women, how women can affect the legal system, and what we can do to fix the myriad things that go wrong within our system. Before we get started, a few quick administrative reminders. First, you can find any of the books that I might mention on the show, as well as a ton of reading lists and recommendations on the Liberating Motherhood Bookshop page at bookshop.org/shop/liberatingmotherhood. The Liberating Motherhood website has a cornucopia of information about my work and about this podcast, including details on how to appear on the podcast, how to submit a story for the podcast, how to submit an advice question, and how to contact me. Check it out at liberatingmotherhood.org. And finally, just a reminder that this podcast is free, but it is not free to make. My work exists solely because of the commitment and generosity of paid subscribers. People who pay to support this work get a bonus podcast every month, at least 8 extra essays each month, and access to the private Liberating Motherhood support group. Subscribe at zahn.substack.com. If you would like to help support the podcast in non-financial ways, you have lots of options. One thing that you need to understand is that social media algorithms across the board are suppressing feminist and leftist content. They think that people don't want to see it. They think that people only want outrage-driven writing and audio. You can tell them otherwise by giving the algorithm what it wants, and what it wants is engagement. So sharing, comments, likes, all of this really do help benefit the podcast. And the other thing that is really beneficial is leaving a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. I know I say this at the beginning of every podcast. I know that you probably fast forward through it. I know you're probably tired of hearing it, but I'm going to keep repeating it because I want to keep making this podcast. And also because having a higher profile for the podcast helps me get amazing guests like the guests we have today. So today I'm going to be talking with Enimai Chettiar. She is president of A Better Balance. She leads the organization's pioneering efforts to advance fair and supportive work-family policies like paid family and medical leave, paid sick time, and fair and flexible scheduling, and to combat discrimination against pregnant people and family caregivers in the workplace. She is a leading civil rights attorney and justice advocate with more than 2 decades of experience leveraging the law to advance transformative reforms. With deep experience in litigation, advocacy, coalition building, and communication, her approach to serving as A Better Balance as president is framed around the intersectionality between social justice, racial justice, and workplace policies that advance meaningful change for women and families. Her personal experiences also drive her passion for A Better Balance's mission to build a future where all workers can care for themselves and their loved ones without risking their economic security. She was appointed as president of A Better Balance in 2024. Previously, she served as deputy executive director of the Justice Action Network, the nation's largest bipartisan criminal justice reform organization. Her leadership and coalition building helped secure the passage of the First Step Act, which released over 30,000 people from prison, the Fair Chance Act, and other key federal legislation. She also served as the director of the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, where she established the center as a national leader in ending mass incarceration, authored groundbreaking reports on crime and incarceration, positioned criminal justice as an issue central to the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections and the national narrative, and worked to transform law enforcement. Through her leadership, mass incarceration became recognized as more than an issue of criminal justice reform and was successfully framed around the deep and generational impact it has on families. She also served as counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union, legal fellow at the Institute for Policy Integrity, and litigation associate at DeBosey and Plimpton LLP. She is a graduate of Georgetown University and the University of Chicago Law School, is widely published in numerous journals, reports, and books, and is quoted extensively across top-tier national media outlets. I'm so excited to have you here. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I am very excited to talk to you today.
I'm really excited to talk to you, and I'll tell you kind of the main reason why is that you have straddled two very, to my mind, different areas of law. You know, you're working on family leave sorts of issues now, but you've previously worked on a lot of criminal justice reform. And I feel like it's pretty uncommon to talk to a lawyer who has so much experience in both. So I think it's awesome. And I thought we might start by talking about what you do, what you're currently working on, and how you landed here.
Yes, happy to. So A Better Balance is a national organization that works on making the workplace more fair for women and for individuals generally. And so what we do, we focus on broadly, I would say legal change that takes many different forms. So we have for the last two decades been fighting in the states to pass laws that, so one, allow for paid sick time, and two, allow for paid family medical leave. So paid family medical leave is longer term medical leave. So if you need to be out for parental leave, or you yourself have some kind of medical condition, or your child or one of your loved ones does that, a law like that would protect you both from ensuring that you have job security, and also making sure that you are continued to be paid. We also have advanced laws at the state level, and most recently, a few years ago, at the federal level, called the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. So that ensures that pregnant workers have access to accommodations and time out of work to take care of pregnancy-related needs. And we do, in addition to passing state laws, we also, and federal laws, we also run a free legal helpline. So this is where we provide advice to all workers, mostly women who are calling in about specific violations from their employers. And then we help them directly by providing legal advice. We also then, when we recognize certain patterns of violations that are happening over and over again, we then bring broader cases in court and class action cases. So that's a little bit about what I do now. In terms of how I got here, so I went to law school because I wanted to help people. I know that probably sounds a bit naive and perhaps common, but that is what my desire was. I had actually initially thought about potentially becoming a therapist. And so I was trying to figure out exactly what I wanted to do. And I ultimately decided that I thought that being a lawyer, I could bring about systemic social change in a way that I couldn't if I was helping individuals one by one. So I went to law school with this passion. I knew that I wanted to do something particularly to help people of color or to help women. I didn't really have it exactly in my head what I wanted to do, but I knew that it was something helping one or both of those two groups. After law school, I went through a roundabout way, ended up in criminal justice reform, and worked on the broader initiative to end mass incarceration. As you might know, we have 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its prisoners. So we definitely have an over-incarceration problem. I worked on that for many years. It was incredibly rewarding, a really intense and issue that affects a lot of communities in the country. During that time, I went through a long and difficult journey to become a mother. And then when I was pregnant, I had some complications. And when, well, I didn't, I had a debilitating pregnancy for both pregnancies. And then when both babies were born, they both had medical issues. So going through all of this, I started thinking about how so many other women in my support groups did not have the supports at work that I had. I had access to paid leave. I had access to sick leave. I had access to accommodations. Both of my pregnancies, I was only able to work from home. I wasn't able to go into an office. I had a ton of doctor's appointments. My kids had a ton of doctor's appointments. And I realized that so many other women don't have access to these same abilities to get out of work. And so I very deliberately was, when I was pregnant with my first kid, I said to myself, when I have my baby, I am going to go and do something different and get involved in some of the more specific gender equity work that was happening around workplaces. And so I was very intentionally looking to shift into the gender and workplace realm. So that is how I ended up at ABB.
Well, I love that you shifted. I love that motherhood maybe didn't change your focus, but expanded it because I think that's a lot of people's experience of motherhood. I have a lot of questions about the work you're currently doing, but before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about the legal system more broadly and specifically the role of lawyers within it. The thing that I'm constantly surprised by is, first of all, I have an international audience, so many of them don't really know how the American legal system works, but also Americans don't really know how the American legal system works. It's very popular to hate lawyers. This seems almost reflexive and unthinking. And it is because in our legal system, a lawyer is typically the only person whose specific job it is to protect people's rights. I often say that anti-lawyer culture is anti-justice culture, and that the efforts to get people to hate all lawyers are specifically designed to get people to distrust the legal system and to not assert their own rights. So I'm hoping you might just, for people who are skeptical of lawyers or litigation, talk briefly about why both can be so important and the role they play in social change.
Yes. So it's interesting when I tell people I'm a lawyer, I feel like I do get a similar response where it's perhaps negative or skeptical. And then when I tell them what I do, then they shift their thinking. Most of the lawyers that I have interacted with in my career have been social justice lawyers at all the organizations that I've worked at. The legal system is a really amazing and very powerful vehicle for social change. I think that we need, as the civil rights movement, even as the criminal justice movement, has shown, we need all sorts of different strategies. So you need a litigation strategy, you need a policy strategy, you need a organizing and grassroots strategy, you need a communication strategy. So I really do think, in terms of what we do, we are using the law to very specifically advance the rights of working women. One way to do that is to secure new rights. And so to be passing these bills that we write and then work to get passed, that can be incredibly powerful because that can may mean the difference of whether or not a woman is allowed to go on light duty instead of heavy duty when she is in her third trimester of pregnancy. And that can make a huge health difference in terms of her health and also the health of her future baby. And so that's one way that we are using the power of law for good. We also, as I mentioned, bring systemic litigation. So right now we have a large class action against Amazon in New York on behalf of all disabled workers in New York that focuses on violations where Amazon has refused to provide specific accommodations to disabled workers when they have asked for them. We have other cases where we are representing pregnant workers that also have had their rights violated by Amazon. And so this is another way that we are able to use the power of the law for social justice. But yeah, it's very interesting. I think that when people first think of lawyers, they think of like people who are out to just get money and people who are working for big corporations and don't necessarily think of the social justice nonprofit lawyers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, my husband is a civil rights litigator, so I'm kind of my only exposure to lawyers is in people who are like in the fight with us. And I'm always try to remind people that for every like insurance defense lawyer you encounter, there's someone fighting them. And those people are doing important work. So I want to talk in some detail about pregnant and postpartum workers and their rights, and in some cases, their lack of rights, because I know that my international listeners are just appalled by how few rights pregnant workers have in the United States. But on the flip side, I work with a lot of women who really believe that they have no rights at all as a pregnant worker. And it's so important to educate them about one, the rights that they do have, and two, the fact that those rights only exist if they enforce them. So could you talk a little bit about what you wish pregnant workers knew?
Yes. So, I think one of the most important things to know about is the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. So this was a bill passed by Congress in 2022. So that means that it applies nationwide to everyone in the country. It applies to most employers. What it does is, so there's, I would say, like two parts to this, if you were to boil it down. One is the right to workplace accommodations, and the second is the right to time off. So, workplace accommodation. So, this is, for example, if you are a cashier at a gas station that is normally required to stand at the cash register, but you are in your third trimester and it would be harmful to your pregnancy to be standing for that long, you can request an accommodation to sit on a stool. You can request an accommodation for water breaks, for being put on light duty, for working from home. There are all sorts of different types of accommodations, mostly physical, that the law allows for. And the standard there is that it must cause the employer undue hardship. So it's really hard to prove undue hardship. So many of these accommodations, as long as you're still able to get as long as you're able to still contribute and get work done, the employer really does need to provide the accommodation. And the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act actually applies even more broadly beyond pregnancy. So, not only does it apply to when a woman is pregnant, but it also applies to if you're seeking fertility treatments, if you are in menopause, if you are seeking abortion care, if you are having some other kind of issue with menstruation or anything really reproductive. And so the second prong of the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act is also time away from work. So the employer is required, they're not required to pay you, but they are required to provide the time off if you need it for a prenatal appointment, for an IVF appointment, for any other type of reproductive related. appointment. So that is very basically what the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act allows for. As I said, the employer has to prove undue hardship, and it has to also be what they call an iterative process. So there needs to be some back and forth between the employee and the employer to be able to go back and forth and figure out what would be the best accommodation for the employee. So that's, generally in terms of the rights, that's probably the strongest right out there. There's also rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act and other pregnancy laws at the state and federal level as well. But the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act is the most on point federal bill. In terms of your other question around enforcement and how it really only works, whether it's been enforced. So I'll use as an example some of our cases into Amazon. So for the last 5 years, we have been looking into Amazon, and what we've learned without question is that one of the richest, most consequential, and powerful companies in the world is systematically abusing, targeting, and pushing out low-wage employees, specifically pregnant and disabled workers. So these are women who are shift employees, hourly employees, and really physical labor workers. So we are bringing lawsuits, including class action, on behalf of these women. This trend is actually fairly widespread. So it's occurring at other companies that are household names, not just Amazon, but also places like Chick-fil-A, Walmart, Speedway. And this is how it basically plays out at Amazon. So when a woman asks for a pregnancy or disability accommodation, so for example, sitting on a stool or leaving early for a doctor's appointment, these companies are denying their requests or punishing them for having basic needs that are legally protected. And then in many cases, they fire the worker, and place them or threaten to place them on unpaid leave. So this basically ends up being a no-win situation for women who are economically at the lowest rung of the workforce and forces them to choose between keeping their job or protecting their health, including safely holding on to an unborn child. And so what these companies are doing is in direct violation of the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. One question worth asking is why these women are being targeted in this way and why this is allowed to have gone on for so long with very minimal to no public attention brought to it so it continues. And I think the answer there is that these are the most vulnerable workers. These are the workers that have the least amount of power, both politically, legally, economically. And this is really where my organization seeks to step in and to provide these women with a voice, but also provide them with the legal tools to be able to enforce their rights and secure them. So this is an overarching issue at come at many companies where there are chronic problems with accommodations being improperly denied. And so this is one example of where the enforcement is really critical.
Well, thank you for doing it. I know that it's demoralizing and enraging and just exhausting work, but it has to be done. And so thank you for leading the charge on that. Where are things with this Amazon lawsuit? Like, what's going on with it?
Yeah, so in November 2025, so about 6 months ago, we filed a class action against Amazon for the treat seeking to hold it accountable for the treatment of thousands of hourly workers across New York State. So our lead plaintiff there is Kayla Leister. She's 27. She picks and packs at an Amazon warehouse in upstate New York, earning $23 an hour. She has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. So that's a genetic connective tissue disorder that is manageable with precaution. So with limited accommodation, such as se occasional seated work and exemption from climbing ladders, she could have continued safely and productively, to do her job. But instead, Amazon denied her a chair, required her to climb, and repeatedly placed her on unpaid leave that she neither requested nor needed. And then she was later threatened with termination for attendance infractions tied to those same medical issues. And the result was unfortunately predictable: lost income, mounting debt, and ultimately job loss. So we are now in kind of preliminary stages of this lawsuit. We are waiting to move through some procedural motions. And so, like I said, we just filed it, so it's at the very beginning stages. But we do have identified many other workers who are in similar positions to Kayla and are ready to move the case forward.
Well, I hope you guys just trounce them in court, although I know it's going to be long and slow and years, but eventually I hope it's a slow roll that just crushes them. So the thing that I really like about your body of work is that you have worked on sort of all of the things that all of us know need to get fixed: paid sick leave and not abusing pregnant workers, the just really obvious fundamental human rights stuff. The thing that I am constantly puzzling over is that everyone I know supports these things. But our politicians continue to treat these like fringe issues, especially when they are women's issues. Why is this? Why do you think politicians continue to view women's human rights as like a special interest niche?
Fantastic question, and something that I've thought a lot about, and a lot of the work that we do at A Better Balance is trying to break through on this challenge. So a couple of things here. One, yes, everyone that we talk to says they support paid leave and says that they support accommodations. But I think unfortunately it is not fully in the top five of what people vote on or what most people vote on. So I think that this issue has a little bit of a challenge where there is broad consensus, but it's not truly a priority. So I think that few voters are voting on it. And I think that few politicians are running on it. Like some have, but I do think that it's, yes, there is support, but it needs to rise up the rung of being at the top of the list. So I think that's one thing, and we are trying to do that. The second thing, I think that politicians haven't fully tapped into or realized that this can be a winning issue. So, take for example, in Virginia, we had Governor Spamberger campaigning on paid leave, and she just signed, sorry, the legislature just passed, and she had previously signed with amendments. So they just passed her version of the bill yesterday. So this is something where she actively campaigned on it. She put forward in her campaign that she was a working woman and this was important to working women, and was able to pass it through an estate that is, not crazy liberal. So I think that I'm hoping can really show people that this is an issue that people can run on and champion and deliver, and that voters will have their back when they do this. So, we had similar challenges to this in, with criminal justice reform, where I guess with criminal justice reform, the arc was slightly different, but there was a point in time where most people came to understand that we did need to reduce our prison population, but it wasn't a top issue that voters were voting on. And so we did a lot of work around trying to get the issue further into like the media narrative, the mainstream narrative, social media narrative, just the culture narrative, so that it would further rise up and really truly be a priority. So we're trying to do some of that work on this issue as well.
Okay. So I want to switch a little bit to criminal justice reform and mass incarceration. And I kind of want to add that we often conceive of mass incarceration as a men's issue. You know, it's something that happens to men. But women are roughly 10% of the incarcerated population. Most incarcerated women are violence survivors, and many are in prisons and jails because of survival crimes. Roughly 10% are pregnant at some point during their incarceration, and I feel that they just get completely forgotten. So, would you mind talking a little bit about how criminal justice reform is a women's issue too, and also how the effects of mass incarceration are not limited to incarcerated populations?
Yes. So, great, very thoughtful question. The first part of the answer, so a lot of women do get caught up in the criminal justice system, and the prison system itself is made for men. And so there's lots of things, you know, prison obviously is a terrible place to begin with. But it causes even more challenges and problems for women. So, for example, for decades, many states were doing this practice of shackling pregnant women. So this is something that I worked on in my previous role, where we brought to public attention this issue of shackling female prisoners who were pregnant, and trying to ban that in various different states. And this is, you know, one very egregious example of how the prison system isn't built with women's needs in mind. But there are many women who do get caught up in the criminal justice system, many of them for fairly small crimes. So a lot of women are in there for drug crimes, for theft crimes, and usually it's because they're poor, right? So they're poor, so they're trying to sell drugs on the side, or you know, they're stealing something to be able to provide for basic needs. So yeah, I mean, I definitely think that it's important that we highlight that mass incarceration is also a women's issue. I also want to talk a little bit about your second point, which is that I think one of the ways that mass incarceration is a women's issue is because of what you said, that the consequences reverberate far beyond prison walls. So, through decades of mass incarceration, the United States has basically deleted swaths of Black men from their communities. And that leaves a whole generation of children who are raised without fathers. And then you have women who are both trying to be the primary caretaker and trying to be the primary breadwinner, and that puts a lot of pressure on women. Also, this entire situation puts a lot of pressure on children, and has a host of really difficult economic and social consequences for the loved ones who are left behind when someone is taken to prison.
Yeah, it's so sad. And you know, the thing that I always tell people is that when you incarcerate one person, you punish their whole family. So even if you think that person is disposable, which they're not, the people around them are not. I want to get on my soapbox about the shackling of pregnant people for a second, because so Pamela Wynne here in Georgia kind of led the charge on getting legislation passed to end the shackling of pregnant people, because she was incarcerated and shackled, and her baby died as a result of it. So, you know, we worked with her for years and years and years to get legislation passed, and it passed, and everyone was so excited. And what's ended up happening is that nothing has changed. They just find loopholes. They just manufacture loopholes to shackle pregnant women. You know, oh, she's crazy. And what they mean by that is that they saw her cry one time. And so I share that because, like, we need that legislation. It's so important. But what we also need is impact litigation for when they seek out these loopholes. And I think that's a big part of what you're doing right now with Amazon, what organizations and criminal justice reform are doing right now. We have to have those lawsuits because that's the only way to enforce these rights.
Yeah, 100%. I think you can pass the law, but it also needs to be implemented and enforced. And I'll say that's one of the things that I have been very impressed with a Better Balance doing, and one of the reasons that I came to work here. I think a lot of legal advocacy groups, and including many of the ones that I worked for in the criminal justice context, focus on passing the bills and don't necessarily do the follow-through of the implementation and enforcement. And that's something that at a Better Balance, our attorneys are really conscious of and want to ensure that when a law is passed, it's actually operating in the intended way.
That's so wonderful and that's so important. I'm really, really glad that is happening. Going back to the criminal justice reform bit, a lot of listeners to this podcast come at the law from the perspective of victimization. They've been raped, they've been stalked, they've experienced violence from an intimate partner. And I am, and they are, consistently stunned by how unseriously the courts take this sort of violence. We see it everywhere, the man in Shreveport who just murdered his children. And the media reports all say, there were no warning signs except for just a few domestic incidents. The police seem shocked the man with history of abusing his partners and children would then kill them. And, none of the rest of us with any sense are shocked. So it's enraging, but I also kind of understand why people respond to this and they want harsher sentencing and they want more incarceration and they want fewer chances. Can you talk a little bit about sentencing incarceration reform and why harsher penalties are not the solution to this problem?
Yeah, so all of these issues are complicated. So I'll start out by saying that it is interesting to me that simultaneously people will hold the belief that longer sentences aren't the answer. When they're talking about criminal justice reform generally, but at the same time also hold the belief that if somebody committed like XYZ specific crime, then they definitely should get the death penalty or life in prison or whatever. So I do think there's some cognitive dissonance there between people being able to understand conceptually about this and versus when there are certain crimes that really trigger people's emotions and are really awful. But looking at the research and the data and the decades of failed experiment of mass incarceration, longer sentences don't do anything to deter crime. So what has been shown to deter crime is swift and certain punishment. So honestly, this is I don't mean to make light of it, but it's a little bit like disciplining a toddler, right? Where it's like you want like they need to know this is going to happen to you and this is going to happen to you right away. And that is what reduces that is one of the things that reduces crime. As opposed to like people don't sit there thinking about, oh, if I do this, I'm going to go away for 20 years. Like that's not the way that people are thinking. So that's one thing to touch on. The second thing is that so many of these issues have really complicated underlying causes that are far beyond an individual's decision making. So there's mental health issues at play, there's economic stressors, there's structural and societal and racial dimensions that it's just far beyond an individual's individual decision making. And so for these and various other reasons, they have discovered that longer sentences do very little to reduce crime.
So here's an issue that I've been ruminating on for a while, and I have not come up with any solutions, and I don't know how to solve it. So I think you might have some more insight than I do. It seems like no matter what legislation we pass. Our culture weaponizes it against the most vulnerable and the most oppressed. A classic example is when regions passed mandatory arrest policies for domestic violence, victims become more likely to be arrested than the people who attacked them. How do we fix this? I mean, obviously, ending racism and white supremacy and sexism would be a solution, but more realistically, is there anything we can do to prevent every single positive thing we do from being weaponized against the most vulnerable?
So I would say I agree with you that there is a lot of that going on. I think maybe I'm a little bit more optimistic. I do think that many of these laws do have positive impacts, do have their intended positive impacts, even if they're not precise and even if they're not as much as we would like. But to your point about the laws that are being weaponized, I mean, some of this is just a lack of resources in the system, a lack of education, a lack of training. The mandatory arrest, I mean, that is controversial too, because there's, one school of thought that says that you should, that this automatically means this is going to be resolved in the criminal justice system. And so, therefore, people are not going to get the social services and support that they need to actually solve the problem. Because the criminal justice, using the criminal justice system to solve these other problems is just putting a band-aid on the situation and making it worse in some cases, or many cases. So, I think using the mandatory arrest to begin with cuts both ways. But then the issue of it being used against victims, I mean, that is like bias. A lot of that is probably bias in the police system and who they're looking at, what colors the victims are, and how they relate to people in the community. It's very complicated, which I feel like is not a satisfying answer. But I do have hope and I am optimistic. Like, I do think that passing these laws is the main way to be able to achieve change. Yes, we have to make sure they're implemented properly. Yes, we have to make sure the actors that have discretion are using the discretion correctly. I mean, that's a big thing that legal change in and of itself can't fix, which is, what you're talking about, which is how actors in the system themselves are using their discretion and whether they're using it for good or not for good, and whether they themselves are biased, and then how that is affecting outcomes.
Think that's an unsatisfactory answer at all. I mean, this is a complex system built upon layers and layers and generations of oppression. So of course the solutions are going to be complicated. And I think it's helpful when we acknowledge that, it's not just this one weird trick will solve it all. So I appreciate that. I want to move outside of the legal system a little bit to something that I think is going to be really resonant for a lot of listeners. When I was doing research for this episode, I found an article you wrote from Ms. Magazine that was just incredible about the false promises and exploitative practices of the IVF industry. So I'm going to read a little excerpt, and I would like to talk about this a bit, if that's okay with you. Here's what you say. IVF was a hot button issue in this year's election, but today's discussion about whether IVF should remain legal leaves out a fundamental point. It assumes that IVF works. This is, however, far from the truth for many, especially Black and Brown women and older women, for whom assisted reproductive technology is far from a miracle cure. Why are we selling women on the idea that they can easily get pregnant after 40 when we know that's exceedingly rare? The answer is money. I would love to hear a bit more about this, about whether you think this is an example of medical racism and misogyny, and about what you think needs to be done about this.
Thank you for bringing this up. This is one of my favorite things to talk about. One of my pet peeves is people thinking that getting pregnant over 40 is easy, and thinking that you can just go to IVF and that's a magic bullet and that's going to solve everything for you. I think that this is an example of women of color and older women being left out of the conversation. I think that when people think about IVF, they are focused on white women who, are in their 30s and have some kind of infertility, like specific infertility challenge, like they have PCOS or endometriosis or something. And that is what IVF is made for. And those women usually get a large number of eggs and are able to go through the IVF process and have kids. And many times, one egg retrieval will yield multiple kids for them. But now what's happening is that IVF, and not now, but for the last whatever decade, is happening is that doctors are sending older women to IVF purely based on age. So I was sent to IVF even before we tried conceiving. They like even before we were even attempting to, and I just went to get things checked out. They said, you should go to IVF. You're over 40. You're going to have better luck with that. And I just thought, this is insane. Like, why am I being sent to IVF? Like, we haven't even tried to conceive naturally. And so in my case, I didn't have anything underlying, but it was due to my age. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. I didn't have an un underlying typical fertility issue. What I had, which many women of color going through IVF have, I had a large fibroid, which is very common in Black and brown women. And when it was removed, it damn. So I had to get it removed in order to sustain a pregnancy because it was too big. And when it was removed, it damaged my uterus. And so my issue was not in terms of creating the egg itself, it was more in being able to then carry to term. And they haven't really looked into solutions for that, right? Like all of the focus on IVF has been around just getting the golden egg and getting the embryo. When we did our first round of IVF, everyone, myself included, thought that, like, oh yeah, one round it's going to work. And everybody was shocked when it didn't. And we actually tried many rounds locally here in New York. And then I realized that most of these doctors do not know how to get older women pregnant. It took me a while to figure that out and a lot of wasted money. And then I ended up going to a clinic out in Denver to do all of my treatments. And the only way that I was able to do that is because this was during the pandemic. So I had a remote job. I had flexibility to be able to go to the procedures. I had the money to be able to fly out there. I had in medical insurance. And most women do not have this. And so, yeah, I mean, I think people think that IVF is easy and it's really not. And so many women in my support groups, who are older, who are Black and brown, end up with no child. And I was very, very lucky that I ended up with, two kids from it.
It's so sad and it's so unsettling. I have a number of friends who have gone through IVF, and I guess I'm a good unofficial infertility doula because they all seem to kind of like drag me into it with them. So I've seen a lot of it. And the thing that I am constantly struck by is how awful the actual process is and how much it puts your body through. And often, frankly, how kind of degrading and condescending the medical professionals are. And, you know, it's not nothing. It's not a small thing for us to ask of women. And I think when we consider the fact that we are asking women to do this over and over again, and it may not work, and their partners may not appreciate the massive sacrifice it is, the whole picture just looks a lot bleaker.
The process itself is very complicated, and it's more so complicated when you have a difficult case. So when I was shopping for clinics and trying to find a new clinic, I ended up speaking to just through friends of friends, connected me to other women who had used this clinic out in Denver, and many of them, like, They did one round. They had no idea what their medications were. They didn't remember anything. They barely saw their doctor, and it all worked out for them, and they had multiple kids from it. Whereas people like me knew every medication, lobbied the doctors for the medication, went and did research, and then asked for specific procedures and medication. I spent so much time researching the problem of IVF, researching the cutting edge, medicines and protocols, and asking for them. Going to different doctors, I did 15 different consults with, again, because of the pandemic, everybody was doing these on televisits over video, and because I had insurance, it was $20 for a consult, which copay for a consult, which most women don't have that, right? But I did, so it was an entire advocacy campaign. And it is something that I think people don't fully appreciate how difficult it is. I mean, I found the most difficult thing to be actually mixing the medicines. So when I did egg freezing, which I did on, obviously I was single in 2016, I would spend like over an hour like mixing the medicine, mixing it incorrectly, needing to like use a different vial. All of that, it would just wasn't intuitive to me. I'm a lawyer, I'm not a scientist. So being needing to mix like 1 milliliter of this fluid with like 2 milligrams of this powder, like I messed it up so many times. And that for me was one of the, and most women, nobody talks about this. Like, no one talks about all of these details of how complicated this is. And like you said, also what your body goes through, not to mention.
Yeah, it's a lot. So you've had two children from IVF now, right?
One kid, So I froze my eggs in 2016, and then we did IVF. So my fibroid surgery was in 2020, and that sort of is what I would call the core of what set off my health issues and maternal health issues, and then my kids had a bunch of downstream effects. So my first kid, we got pregnant in 2020. Two, no, no, 20, yeah, 2021, I guess. And she was born in 2022. And then we did fresh eggs then. So I used my 42-year-old eggs for that. I wanted to save the frozen eggs for a second kid. And then I had very bad luck with the frozen eggs. The first batch I did over here in New York. And those all died in the lab. And so then we shipped the second batch of those over to Colorado. And then I had my kid from my frozen eggs last year. So she just turned one.
Well, I'm glad your kids made it here. I'm also sorry that you had to go through all of that. Have you heard this kind of emerging research investigation into the idea that, like, we don't really know how to correctly freeze eggs and maybe egg freezing doesn't actually work so well?
Yes, if that's another thing, right? That people think egg freezing is an insurance policy, and it's not. I froze 21 eggs, and only one egg made it into an embryo, and I was lucky enough that that one embryo turned into a kid.
Wow.
And I don't think people realize, like in retrospect, to really do egg freezing and to make it be an insurance policy, you would need to freeze like 60 eggs at three different clinics. Which is some of the advice that people are giving now, which is obviously insanely expensive. But yes, I think that they don't, the egg freezing is really, eggs are very, very fragile, and it's very difficult to freeze. It is definitely something that most people don't know about, that egg freezing is not a guarantee.
So, having gone through this and more or less come out on the other side with what a lot of people pursuing IVF would consider a successful outcome, what would you tell other women? Because I know so many listeners are going to hear this and say, well, okay, but what was the recipe? Like, what worked? What do you wish you knew, and what do you wish other women knew going into this?
So I wish I knew how hard it was going to be for over 40. I feel like as modern women, as feminists, as progressives, I really didn't pay much attention to the biological age issue, and I didn't really want it to be an issue. I didn't wait on purpose. I was looking for a partner, and it took me a lot longer to find a partner than I thought it would. But I did not expect it to be this difficult. So that's one thing, is it's not easy to have kids in your 40s. I'm sure that there are many stories where people have had an easy time. I don't think that is true for women of color or women who have any kind of medical issue like the fibroid that I had. So that's the top thing. The second thing in terms of the recipe. So I approached having a kid the same way that I approached passing legislation. I did an entire campaign. I spent so much of my time on this. I researched, I called doctors, I talked to other women, I found information. I very proactively asked for specific things of doctors. I talked to my doctor all the time. Many women who go through this only talk to their nurse. They don't know that you can actually request multiple appointments with the doctors. So I'm sure my doctors thought I was annoying, but I talked to them all the time. Didn't just follow what the doctor said. If I had followed what the doctor said, I would have died. I probably wouldn't have had my two kids, just in general, from all of the medical things that we've been through. Because I think doctors know a lot, but they don't know everything. And they particularly don't do well when you don't fit a textbook definition of something, which I think is the case for many women of color. And I always questioned what the doctor said. I asked a lot of questions, did my own research, and I prayed a lot. And I was prepared and ready to go through all of our finances. I had an apartment in New York that I sold to pay for IVF treatments. So I mean, it's crazy, but that's how badly I wanted kids. So it was a lot of work and it was a lot of resources and I mean, worth it, but hard.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's crazy. You know, this is perhaps our most intense biological drive. And I often think about women who desire kids with that intensity and who go through all of this and for whom it's not successful and what they've lost. And it's very sad.
It's really sad. And I will say, many women that I know who weren't successful, but a lot of it is the doctors tell you, they act like they know everything. So, many doctors will tell women, okay, you're X, you know, whatever, 40 years old, you must go to donor eggs. I wish they wouldn't say that. I wish they would say, hey, there's this other clinic over here, and they actually specialize in this different cutting edge medicine. Maybe you should go try them. So, this is the other thing that I was really struck with IVF, which I didn't realize until I did all of those consults, that, all of these clinics do it differently. They all do it differently. Even from doctor to doctor, it varies. It's not like a cardiologist where you walk in and there's 99% of doctors all do a stent in the exact same way. That's not what this is. Every single clinic does it completely differently. And there's no transparency into any of this. And the only way that you find out what they do is to actually go through it. And most of them use the first round as a test round. So you're wasting what, $30,000 on a test round just for them to see how your body reacts. And then they end up calibrating and this, that, and the other. So yeah, I mean, I think that something else I'd want women to know is, all these doctors do it differently. If it doesn't work at one place, switch doctors, switch clinics. They'll like something, some there are many different ways to approach this, and there's different ways to get success, and different people's bodies are going to work with different things.
That's such helpful advice, and I think that's going to hopefully help at least one person listening to this. So thank you for that. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been amazing and illuminating, and you've just done so much. And I know listeners are really going to appreciate having you here.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to talk to you and really enjoyed our conversation.
Awesome. Listeners, so I am going to put lots of additional links and information in the show notes where you can learn more. And I will be back with you next week. So thank you for listening.